Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:27 British Summer Time. Today is Friday, the 19th of August, of April, excuse me. And this being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, if we have a review of what's been happening this week, and it really has been very eventful, then gold pulled back by in the region of $100 on Monday and has since stabilized. And today pushed back above the $1,400 area and at least some steadying in this region. And I'll speak more about gold in a moment. Elsewhere, the S&P 500 pulled back sharply and came back to the lower side of what is about a six-month range and has steadied there in here today. And it finished out the day up about 0.9%. The Japanese market continues to remain really quite firm, and the second section, which we've often looked at as a lead indicator, pushed onto new high ground into the latter half of this week. The Chinese market, which rallied so impressively in the latter couple of weeks of last year and the first month of this year, has been in a corrective phase since really the beginning of February, but has closed its overextension relative to the 200-day moving average, and we're starting to see some evidence of demand returning in that region. And while today's upward dynamic isn't really conclusive evidence, it is at least what we would like to see in a region of potential support in order to turn a bit more bullish. With the amount of quantitative easing that's going on in Japan in particular, that represents a significant amount of additional money supply being pumped into the global economy. And a good deal of that is finding its way into other Asian countries. So this week, the Malaysian market hit a new all-time high, and the Indonesian market did the same. And Singaporean banks are leading their respective market higher. And what we're seeing is that the ASEAN region more generally continues to attract investor interest, not least because it is the world leader in terms of GDP growth, in at least in within countries that we can invest in rather easily. There are obviously some countries in Africa which have stronger, even stronger growth rates, but they're not that easy to invest in. Then Asia has a burgeoning middle class, and not only is it has it got large populations, but the populations of the disposable income class are increasing, and the numbers of people with progressively more disposable income is also rising, and that is helping to drive a major bull market in consumer-related sectors. Elsewhere this week, gold shares have been deteriorating really for much of the last year, but a number are now pulling back to the region of their 2008 lows. In fact, a number have actually dropped below their 2008 lows, and that represents a significant acceleration. And anyone who's been to the chart seminar will recognize that acceleration is an ending signal. Now, we do not have any evidence just yet that the acceleration has ended and that we really need an upward dynamic and really quite a large one to suggest that or to prompt short covering. But when you're getting multiples down into single figures, and when yields are competitive by just about any measure, then there's an awful lot of bad news has already been priced into the market. And in order for the acceleration to persist, that bad news will have to get worse. So that brings us back to gold. And if we look at the chart over the last 10 years, there was a really... It was a difficult chart to work with, and a large part of it would have had to have been faith-based, and a large number of people had that faith and rode the market up to $1,900. And some of the consistency characteristics that were there was that gold was prone to lengthy periods of consolidation. It tended to break out of those lengthy consolidations in Septembers of uneven years. And when it did complete a lengthy range, then, as we defined it at the chart seminar, a range is an explosion waiting to happen. And golly, was gold capable of exploding to the upside. And then it became temporarily overextended, and it pulled back towards the 200-day moving average, where more often than not it found support before entering another lengthy period of consolidation. And then the chart became progressively more consistent. And from 2009 through to 2011, we saw a number of additional new highs, and the ranges became less lengthy and less volatile. And then we saw really quite an impressive advance all the way up to 1900. And then it pulled back again. And in September of last year, it retested the $1,800 area. And if it was going to reassert the medium-term uptrend, then that would have been the best time for it to do so. But it didn't do that. And it pulled back below the 200 AMA. And then it encountered resistance at the moving average. And even then, it spent a good time ranging. But then it broke downwards last week, and it really collapsed out of that range. And just as we've seen accelerations out of ranges in the past, then this was another explosion waiting to happen, and the explosion this time happened on the downside. So now we're in a position where people have been shocked by the speed with which gold has pulled back. And certainly there will have been people that have sold, if not all of their position, part of their position, and they'll be wondering what to do with prices at this level. And we're starting to hear, on the one hand, of jewelry manufacturers hoovering up gold at this level, and central banks beginning to become more interested, and people who collect coins looking at this as a buying opportunity, and the Indian market looking at importing additional gold to meet demand in that market. And on the other, we see that the holdings in ETFs continue to deteriorate. And when gold hit its peak, that wasn't the peak in gold ETF holdings. In fact, the consistency of that trend didn't really break down until early March, when it broke below its 200-day moving average for the first time in 10 years. And now we're in this war. And considering the fact that gold has thrived, particularly when quantitative easing was brought into play, when we look at what has happened, and when we look at where the fact that money supply is certainly still abundant, but people are beginning to think about how the quantitative easing and extraordinary monetary measures that have become such a feature of the market in the last 5 years are going to actually be withdrawn. And that represents a challenge for those that are looking at gold and comparing it to other asset classes. When we look at where gold is right now, then it is oversold. And there is the potential for some additional ranging. And in a best case scenario, it pushes back up. But such has been the technical deterioration that when we look at gold, then there is an overhead top formation now. And it really does need to get back above the $1,600 area and sustain a move above it and back above the 200-day moving average to break the progression of lower rally highs that have been evident since September and really convince people that the demand component is back in charge. Now, there are still a large number of bullish arguments for why one should own gold, not least because of the flagrant disregard for the value of money among central banks, and because gold miners are spending more to get less out of the ground. And the fact that gold mining shares have pulled back so very aggressively does support the contention that the supply of new gold will contract, because at present levels, there's a number of those gold miners are going to be at uneconomic levels. So that represents a potential bullish fact over the medium term. But those bullish factors don't really mean a great deal unless we have the demand component to actually back them up. And it isn't just about demand. The supply situation is very much dominant at present. And one of the great bullish factors that has been used for gold for so long is that it is immutable, and that most of the gold that has ever been mined still exists. But because it isn't like other commodities that are used up when somebody buys them and then makes use of them, gold still sticks around, and that represents potential supply when that inventory gets liquidated. And we are seeing that in the ETF holdings. So we have seen a pause in the gold price, and I bought some gold earlier this week in anticipation of some of the short-term oversold condition being unwound. And I still hold that because I think that there is potential for an additional rally from here. But if I was being very cautious, I think that what is probably perhaps more likely is that we're going to see some additional volatility. And there is a possibility at this stage that the lows will be retested. So this remains a dangerous environment for gold. And while there is capacity for an unwind of the short-term oversold condition, it needs to do substantially more than that to really begin to convince people that this is going to be another year which gold can hit a new high, or at least churn out a positive return. One of the most consistent things about gold since 2000 is that it has put in a positive return, I think, on just about every year consecutively until this year. So when it will have to do an awful lot if it is going to turn out a positive return this year. And against that background, the S&P 500 hit a new all-time high last week. And that is the first new high since 1999. So there is definitely the capacity for some additional ranging in this area. And the S&P does look like it is in a process of pulling back towards the mean. And we've been talking about a corrective phase for stock markets since really the end of January and the beginning of February. And Europe has been where the majority of that correction has occurred. And we've seen quite a bit of mean reversion in parts of Asia as well, not least in China and in India. And Wall Street has been the holdout, and it does now look like we are in a process of mean reversion for the S&P 500. But it is interesting that when we look at some of the autonomies, for example, Nestle or Unilever, where they pulled back rather sharply this week, and Nestle, having posted a downside key reversal, I think it was, if it's not 3 weeks, it was 4 weeks ago, and then has been pulling back, it got right down to the 200-day moving average this week, and then rallied spectacularly away from it. So we can see that in these types of shares where people want to own them, and where we see these shares that are really leveraged to the growth of the global consumer and dominate their respective niches and have not only a dominant presence within their own market, but are truly global, and not least in the case of some of the big consumer companies, have really quite considerably long records of increasing their dividends, then these are the types of shares that people want to own, and they're queuing up to buy them on a pullback. So we've seen that particularly on Nestle and Unilever and even Rexham this week, that there were some really quite spectacular rallies following what had been a stiff pullback intra-week. And Procter & Gamble, which has been sort of range-bound for a number of weeks, pushed on really very impressively in here today to post another new all-time high. And that's another, that's practically a fund all by itself. It's so ingrained in such a wide number of areas within the consumer segment. And Johnson & Johnson continues to extend its advance. Now, that one is becoming a bit overbought in the very short term. And when it does eventually start to pull back, then it is probably going to be one of those shares that when it comes back towards the region of the moving average, that there will be people lining up to buy it at that type of level. So we are presented with some, in a reactionary phase, that there are some really very attractive opportunities. And the growth of the global consumer remains an abiding theme, and it's likely to remain an abiding theme for at least the next decade, and potentially even more from that, considering that the global population is likely to expand by approximately 50% in the next 30 years. And for the first time, that not only are we going to have more people, but that an increasing number of those people will have the disposable income necessary to help improve their standards of living. And that the fact that capitalism has been adopted as an economic system across the majority of the world at this stage is helping to unleash the productive capacity of an increasing number of people. And in comment of the day today, I've highlighted a number of Taiwanese technology shares that, and MediaTek in particular, is breaking out of, well, looks like it is going to complete a first step above its base. And that's a manufacturer for other people's designs, by and large, in terms of the chip manufacturing industry. And Arm Holdings, which had done so spectacularly well with Apple, is in a process of mean reversion as well. But it is interesting that the company made more from embedded processing in the last quarter of last year than it did from mobile technology. And embedded processing, where processors and sensors and communication devices are being inserted into an increasing number of industrial processes, represents a significant productivity gain. And it's likely to make industrial automation mainstream. And those types of innovations represent significant productivity gains for the industrial sector. So that is something that will help facilitate a bull market over the next decade. And what we're starting to see is that the ducks are starting to get in line for the types of themes that can drive a major bull market in stocks over the next decade, and perhaps even longer than that. What remains the big uncertainty is that how are central banks going to wean capital markets off of extraordinary monetary measures? And it's a very big question, and nothing like this has ever been attempted before. But at present, we see that the Fed is in quantitative easing mode, and Japan, with an economy approximately a third of the size of the USA, is taking on an almost equally large quantitative easing program to the Fed. And Europe is making abundant liquidity available to the financial sector via the discount window, and the Swiss National Bank is printing Swiss francs in order to maintain its hedge against, or its peg, I should say, against the euro. And the Bank of England is tolerating an above target inflation rate and has been doing so for the last 3 or 4 years in order to attempt to inflate its way out of its troubles. So there is no shortage of money in the financial system. And the fact that we've had a liquidity fuel rally now for the last 4 years means that people anticipate that monetary accommodation is likely to remain a significant factor. But when the velocity of money starts to improve and when growth starts to become self-sustaining in some of these bigger economies, then the natural policy for central banks would be to start to remove some of that extreme accommodation. And that does mean that the instruments that have been pumped up by liquidity rather than really being supported by sound fundamentals will pull back. And that will probably result in a year, perhaps 2 or 3 years of ranging and increased volatility for stock markets. And if we look at how the last secular bear market and valuation contraction ended on Wall Street in 1980, the market broke upwards in 1980, but valuations didn't bottom until 1982. And what happened in between that was a good deal of ranging. And given that we have this uncertainty sitting out there on the horizon, then the likelihood that we could be in for a year or two of ranging once we've completed this lengthy consolidation is really quite high. Now, when we look at commodity shares generally, they are worthy of mention, not because they've been hitting new highs, but really rather the opposite. And for example, BHP Billiton currently has a PE in the region of about 8 and yields over 4%. And it's back to test the lower side of its range. And industrial metals have been pulling back so aggressively that copper is back to $3 on that COMEX contract, or $3.16 at the close in here today, and has deteriorated quite markedly this week and over the last few weeks. When we look at the speed with which industrial metal prices have pulled back and the chunk that is taken out of the valuations of mining shares, then we are starting to get back into potentially interesting levels. When we look at these types of companies, and particularly those that have got a significant amount of cash on the sidelines, and we see that prices for the industrial resources themselves have pulled back to such an extent that some of the more debt-emburdened companies will be getting into trouble at this stage, then the prospect for mergers and acquisitions to increase at this level does suggest that that should help to put a floor under the market when it does start to occur. And considering the fact that we've seen some of the major miners pull back so aggressively, and the fact that their valuations are really quite low, should help to also support them at these levels. There's been a great deal of anxiety about what's going to happen in China, and not least because the market has been pulling back for much of the last 2 months. And there was someone asked a question, and I answered in comment of the day today, about the integrity of the financial sector and the debt to GDP ratios in China when one takes into account the amount of off-balance sheet lending that has happened. And that off-balance sheet lending is a problem, and it will have to be addressed at some stage. But the question is whether that is going to be now. Because what we are starting to see is that the Chinese have expanded their trading bans for the yuan, or they're in the process of doing so, and they've opened up the domestic capital markets to foreign inflows. So that should help to stoke additional interest in the banking sector. And the banking sector is by far the largest sector in the domestic market. So that should also help to stoke investor interest in the wider market as a measure. But we also have to bear in mind that while infrastructure and low-cost manufacturing got China to where it is today, if it's going to continue on the road to progressively creating wealth, then the process of reform is going to need to persist. And allowing the consumer the freedom to save less is going to be a big part of that. And anything that allows generally consumers to spend more of their disposable income, then that should help to boost that economy and create a greater spread of reliance, so that rather than just concentrating on the property sector and on manufacturing, that it will also have consumer demand to act as a counterweight to those other factors. And India is probably a country that is among one of the greatest beneficiaries of lower energy prices. And over the last couple of weeks, Brent crude has pulled back to the $100 area, and West Texas Intermediate is back towards the $88 area. And India has been rallying as oil prices have been coming off, because it helps to moderate the inflationary outcome and it eases the pressure that's on the RBI to target inflation. So that really is very positive indeed. Now, just as we've seen with a large number of the other commodities, oil is oversold at this level, and there is the potential for a bounce in here. But when we look at it longer term, there is plenty of oil and there's plenty of gas in the world today. And the technology that is necessary to get it out of the ground is becoming a global phenomenon. And it's down to governance, whether governments are willing to put the needs of their populations and the needs of their economies ahead of ideology. And where they are willing to do that, we're going to see a surge in supply from unconventional sources. And where they're not willing to do that, then those economies are going to suffer. But what we are seeing in Asia, is, and particularly in China, is that they're investing heavily in exploiting their own resources, not least in the unconventional oil and gas sector. So we can anticipate that in the next decades, that energy is going to become more abundant. And while demand for that energy will continue to trend higher, that the pressure that we have and the tight situation that is evident in the energy markets will start to ease over the coming decade. And that represents a significant current headwind that is likely to turn into a tailwind over the next couple of decades, and should also help to support a secular bull market on Wall Street. But that's a decade-long view, and we're still in the very early stages of that development. And where we look at currencies, the dollar has declined from its highs earlier in the decade and has been largely range-bound for the last 3 or 4 years on a dollar index basis. And there's every likelihood that this could be a base. And while we're a long way from completing that base, the case for a dollar collapse is not well founded when one compares it to other currencies. And there's been a great deal of commentary about the potential for a currency war. But what we're seeing now at the G20 is that there is no currency war, and that most of these other countries are willing to sit on the sideline and allow Japan to attempt to break its deflationary cycle by deliberately targeting inflation. But when we see that so many countries are adopting quantitative easing, then one has to think about how to preserve the purchasing power of one's wealth. And with that in mind, the fact that we're seeing so many of what we term the autonomies, which are those companies that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer and that dominate their respective niches and that have in many cases, long histories of increasing their dividends, they represent probably the best hedge against inflationary pressures that are out there. And inflation is often a difficult topic to define. So let's talk about it more in terms of purchasing power. And if we talk about inflation in terms of purchasing power, then we definitely need to be in those types of sectors that are going to outperform, not over the short term, but over the medium term. And as long as we're seeing Wall Street in this reactionary phase at present, then that should help to support prices for the government bonds. But just as at the top of every major bull market, we see that the supply of whatever it is explodes. Well, there's no shortage of bonds out there, and yields are at, well, real yields are negative. So this is a momentum move in government bonds for North America and for much of Europe and Japan. And when that momentum ends, then we are going to see yields rise. And anyone who's buying at this stage is going to suffer really quite heavily in terms of the loss of their purchasing power, and they're going to lose on their rolls, and they're going to lose on the reinvesting of their coupons. So it's not an attractive asset class at present. But it hasn't broken down yet. And when we look at it on a total return basis, then treasuries continue to trend higher. But when we look at, and rather than attempting to be retrospective, and we try to anticipate what's going to happen with markets, and we try to see where the value is, then the value is in equities rather than in government bonds, even though government bonds haven't yet broken down. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.